This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away. The recent tragedies in nightclubs in Chicago and Rhode Island have focused attention on the issue of safety in public places. In both cases, investigators are focusing on the owners of the clubs. In Chicago, where 21 people were killed in a crowd crush, officials say the club was under a court order barring the use of the second floor of the club because of building code violations. The club owners say they had an agreement that allowed them to open the second floor facility. In Warwick, Rhode Island, where 97 people were killed in a fire that engulfed a nightclub, law enforcement officials say they are seeking the cooperation of the club owners in determining who was at fault for allowing a rock band to set off a pyrotechnic display in the small space. Both incidents raise questions about who exactly is responsible for public safety in private spaces. In the case of the Rhode Island nightclub, for instance, a sprinkler system could have saved lives, but the owners were under no legal obligation to install one. Does that mean the government is to blame for not requiring sprinklers, or should club owners be expected to install safety devices even if it isn't the law? Where does the responsibility lie? Such questions take on even greater importance in the age of terrorism, where private buildings from office towers to shopping malls could become the targets of terrorist attacks. How much is the government doing to ensure that businesses are taking the steps needed to protect the public? How carefully are safety regulations being enforced? What is the responsibility of the business sector, and who pays the bill? Public safety in private spaces is the subject of today's Talk of the Nation. To join the conversation, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. To give us the latest on the investigation taking place in Rhode Island is Martha Biebinger, a reporter for member station WRNI in Providence. Thanks for being with us, Martha.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Good. Tell us, where does the investigation stand right now?
Well, the investigation on the criminal front starts with earnest tomorrow with the imposition of a grand jury. We know that members of the band Great White have been subpoenaed. Some of them have signed on with local attorneys here in Rhode Island. They started fireworks that initial reports indicate caught some sort of material, probably some soundproofing material in the ceiling of the club, that spread very rapidly. The fire spread very rapidly through the club. The chief of the fire department in West Warwick has said that the fire probably consumed the building in about 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So when we start with the on the criminal front, we've got investigation of the band and the club owners, as you said earlier. Then somewhat separately is the investigation of the fire and exactly what happened. That's tests of the soundproofing equipment, a review of the inspector's notes, whether the building was up to code or not, and whether there might have been any other elements that contributed to the fire.
So they're testing this insulation that was used in the nightclub for its flammability. Is that right?
That's right. The material has to meet a standard that's called a flame spread rate, meaning how fast does a fire spread across the surface of that material. Witnesses who have been in the building say that that material was old and fairly crumbly. Inspectors that I've talked to from outside West Warwick, but who inspect other places in the state, say that when you go into a building where there's no longer documentation about the rate on that material, say the building has changed owner several times, inspectors are supposed to test that. They're actually supposed to light a piece of it to see how quickly it burns or how quickly fire spreads across it. The documents that would tell us when or if that was done for this club in West Warwick are under investigation, and they're not releasing them at this time.
Now, Martha, as I understand it, this building didn't need to have water sprinklers because of its size. Is that code being reviewed by fire officials right now?
That's one of many things that's being reviewed. That's right. Yes, a building at capacity of 300 or smaller in Rhode Island, and I believe that this is true in many states across the country, is not required to have fire sprinklers. But there's been a special commission set up at the state legislature here, and also with fire and building safety officials that will review fire sprinkler safety. Many questions that might make the fire codes stricter in Rhode Island.
Have other businesses in the area expressed concern about the safety of their buildings? Are they looking into the safety of their buildings now?
Well, they're both looking and they're being looked at. There were reports initially of club owners calling fire inspectors actually and saying, come check out my place again and see is there anything here that I need to be paying special attention to. But separately, Governor Don Carcieri has ordered an investigation, or actually a review of the fire inspections for all clubs of the size of the station, meaning of 300 and smaller. So fire inspectors are fanning out across the state to using the same code, but just making sure that they didn't overlook something or make a mistake, or whether something has changed since the last inspection was done. They're reviewing all of those fire inspection licenses again to be sure that they are up to date.
Well, thanks so much, Martha.
Thank you.
Martha Bevinger is a reporter at member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Joining us now in Studio 3A is Jake Pauls. He's an independent consultant on building use and safety and focuses on codes and standards for building design. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good afternoon, Lynn.
You've just heard Martha Bevinger's report. Is it surprising to you that a public place that can accommodate up to 300 people isn't required to have a sprinkler system?
No.
Why not? Well, I mean, this seems to raise questions in my mind, certainly, about exactly when is a sprinkler system required?
Well, the national standard called the Life Safety Code only requires for new construction sprinklers for 300 and more. Now, the derivation or the origin of that rule is somewhat obscure. I'm sure it's going to be reassessed. I know where my personal position is on that, since I favor the sprinkling of homes, and hence nightclubs of 300 or less would be included as being sprinklered in my view.
How different are the codes from city to city, state to state, town to town?
Well, there are over 40,000 jurisdictions apparently in the United States that can adopt codes for construction, and hence there is a lot of variability. Some use or base their local requirements on national codes, what are called model codes or standards. Some don't. Some cities, for example, Chicago and New York, have their own requirements. They write them from scratch. So there is quite a bit of variability with the requirements. There's also variability with regard to enforcement.
First of all, should there be some kind of national building code? Is that possible at all?
Well, this is the United States, and under the Constitution, apparently that rests with the states and local jurisdictions, depending on the state. I know where I stand on that, and a lot of other people would like to see one code. Now, most of the people advocating a single code are doing that for their own convenience. In other words, designers and engineers would like to work only to one document rather than with many, simply to make their job easier.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always one factor. But certainly in terms of the expectation of the public for uniformity, the public doesn't realize, for example, that when they cross from one county or one city to another, that there may be a totally different code. And so they may have the incorrect expectations for the kind of facility they're in.
We're talking about the codes, but what is the responsibility of the business, the private business, to work with the government in terms of implementing these codes? I mean, what's the follow-up? You have a code, it has to be put into place by a business, and it seems like this, as with so many other things, it's follow-up that sometimes is the problem, isn't it, in terms of checking to make sure it's all really in place?
Well, it's a bit complicated here because we have to separate out new construction requirements
mm-hmm.
and the requirements that apply to existing buildings, sometimes covered under fire codes. Now, this national document called the Life Safety Code, published by the National Fire Protection Association, it's probably the most widely used standard or code of that type. It covers both new and existing construction. That's very unusual, by the way. Most codes address only new construction, or they address the operation of existing construction under a fire code. Unfortunately, the fire codes tend to stress, or at least have a lot of the requirements dealing with industrial facilities and not so much on things like crowd management in public facilities. So that's kind of a left-out area.
Now, when you work with people who are putting up new buildings for new businesses, how much concern do people have for these safety issues? How much concern do you think there is? Or are they an afterthought?
It varies a lot. I've been involved with some large facilities of, say, 20,000-person capacity where the local jurisdiction, anxious to get that facility into operation, would not permit its inspectors to inspect it before occupancy. So I think that's the most extreme end of the spectrum that I've been involved with. And in that case, the local newspaper brought me in to do an inspection a week before the building opened so that the public would have a more safe building. But that's a case where the the local, the owner and the local jurisdiction failed totally, in my opinion. Now, you get that at one end of the spectrum, right to the most cooperative of facilities, where there's a very high level of cooperation among the owner, the designers, the builders, and the local authorities, who would be both building department authorities and fire authorities. We'd like to go for that model where everyone's working with the same song sheet, so to speak, and doing their job to the best of their ability. I think that's somewhat unusual, however, for a variety of reasons.
All right. If you'd like to join our discussion here at Talk of the Nation, the number is 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about public safety in private spaces. And you can reach us by email at totn@npr.org. We're trying to assess also, what is the responsibility of the private sector in this? I mean, earlier we started out talking about the codes that are in place. What is the private sector responsibility in ensuring the safety of the public in their space?
Well, first of all, they have a duty to meet all of the applicable laws and regulations. They also have a duty which may go beyond that. In other words, the duty of reasonable care, as seen in the courts, would ask more of the owner than merely meeting the minimum legal requirements. Because in some cases not anticipated by the legal requirements, there may be additional hazards posed. So under law, the owner bears the responsibility to meet the requirements and maybe some additional things as well.
All right, let's take a call from Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
My concern really is in terms of some of the people need to take a very good look at the importance that a nightclub plays within society. It allows people to mingle, mix, what have you. In terms of the fire safety issues, in San Francisco, I've opened two of the largest nightclubs here in San Francisco. We went through a vigorous permit process. There is continuously monitoring of the clubs for the most part. And I must say that all this is way too familiar ground. There was talk about additional insulation added for soundproofing at a later date. And in that case, I start wondering, who was approving the building permits that are required to do this sort of work. A lot of this stuff is still in place. And when I say that, I'm saying is that the laws that are existing on the books provide for that. It's a question of whether the nightclub owners adhere to them.
Yeah. Peter, how much emphasis do you put on safety when you're getting a nightclub up and running? How much attention do you pay to that?
Well, actually, this goes back as far as 1980. We were at Club DVA. We were one of the first clubs to use headset microphones, boom microphones, for the security. And radio, as far as it goes, is critical in a nightclub situation. If the general public sees headset microphones and high-quality radios on the security staff, it's a pretty good indication that the club is well-run. Another indication could be, or another thing that could be asked as part of a conditional use permit, is that local police be allowed to monitor that nightclub security channel so that they're immediately aware of the size and the complexity of the venue and event that's occurring. And that way you would not have these problems.
How about staff training? How important is that?
It's very important, and the problem is that there is no unified form of staff training. You do not go to a school for nightclub security. And in many cases, in the case of rental security, or what they refer to as a rental club, a uniformed type security individual who may be brought in on a temporary basis for a particular event, these people have no crowd training. If anything else, what they are usually assigned to do is simply to prevent access or a circumstance where there is referred to as entry, no entry. A single access point is usually the front door.
Thanks so much, Peter, for your call. We're going to have to go for a short break, and we'll continue our discussion about public safety in private places when we return. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about how prepared communities and businesses are to respond to emergencies, including terrorist attacks, and who's responsible for footing the bill. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest this hour is Jack Pauls, who consults on building use and safety. And joining us now in the discussion is Larry Soren. He's president of BOMA International, which is the Building Owners and Managers Association. They represent the office building industry in North America. He's also vice president of Kim Lee and Haygood, a commercial real estate and property management company in Spokane, Washington. Larry Soren joins us from member station KPBX in Spokane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Lynn. Good afternoon.
When you hear about disasters like the nightclub tragedies that we have been discussing so far, does it make you think more about safety in the buildings that you run? I mean, are you more concerned looking into that more now in the wake of these disasters?
Well, I think for our business over the last year and a half, we've been looking at that since September 11th.
Uh-huh.
We've had obviously several issues, particularly high-rise office buildings, that have forced us to take a look at security, safety, and codes. And there are a lot of venues that the codes are being reviewed right now. And we're a key part of that because we're big advocates of good safety codes and good safety practices.
Well, what are some of the things that the owners of high-rise buildings in particular are doing to address the concerns of the public about safety?
Education and communication are probably number one. One of the efforts that we support wholeheartedly is continued education of our tenants in the buildings and continued drilling of how to evacuate, etc. Recognizing in an office building you're dealing with typically people who are familiar with their surroundings. They're not there for the first time, although there may be some visitors. And that we try to instill in them a sense of how they should respond in the event of an emergency, where the exits are, how to evacuate, where to go, etc.
Do you ever get complaints from building owners that building codes or fire codes are just too complicated or too expensive to comply with?
Well, there, yes, you probably hear some building owners who are always concerned about cost. As in general, as an industry, cost is not our number one issue. Reliable codes based on sound research and science, that's where our focus is. That's where BOMA's been all along, is to try to make sure that as we go through the codes consensus process through the ICC or the NFPA, that those codes are developed in a manner that reflects good practice, good science, and that there's a reasonable likelihood that implementing that code will actually make a difference.
What about concerns about insurance costs, particularly since 9/11?
Insurance has been on our plate since 9/11. The terrorism insurance issue is in the works now. As many of people may know, or many of your listeners know, that bill was passed in November. This week was the 90-day deadline for insurance companies to give pricing. I understand there's variability as to who, which buildings are accepting terrorism insurance and which aren't. But the fact is, terrorism insurance itself won't make a building safer.
And do some companies view security as the government's responsibility, that it's not the responsibility of the private sector?
I think, generally speaking, security, as we look at it, is really a three-pronged approach. I think the government has a role, as Jake was talking about, in the codes adherence process. I think that local governments need to be a part of the inspection process, not only when they check plans, but when they actually build out buildings. I think it's up to the property owner, the developer, the built facility manager to abide by the codes, to continue to maintain their building in compliance with the code. And I think there's a third leg, and that is that no matter how good the code is, no matter how extensive it is, the public has to be aware of their need to be aware of their surroundings, to understand mm-hmm. what's going on around them, to know in that nightclub, for example, where the exits are. And that's a new thing to think about now.
Yeah. And Jake Pauls, if a business is irresponsible, is there any way of cracking down on a business that disregards the codes, that doesn't pay enough attention to safety? Is there anything in place for that?
Well, the most convenient thing is simply to call the Fire Prevention Bureau of the local fire department, because they can act most quickly with existing facilities.
Okay, we're talking about public safety in private places. Let's take a call now. Hugh in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead, Hugh.
Hey, I'm come from a little bit of a wacky party, a Libertarian Party, and we're much into self-responsibility. And it's my personal opinion that businesses need to be a lot more proactive on making sure that their buildings are as safe as possible. And if their building isn't as safe as it should be, as in the case of Rhode Island, which, I mean, there's no excuse for a building to go up in 3.5 minutes. I think the building owners should be prosecuted, and club owners.
Okay, Jake Pauls, I mean, this raises the question of how do you know when a building is really unsafe, except when a tragedy like this occurs? And in fact, in this particular case, it's very possible that somebody will be, it's possible somebody will be prosecuted, and it may be the club owners indeed. Not yet, but it's a possibility. So until it happens, how does a person know?
Well, the public takes buildings on a good faith basis, and maybe that's not totally justified, because it isn't just the owner. There's a whole system of people who have a role in this. So the rock bands, for example, the managers, promoters, local authorities, licensing bureaus, and so forth. The public places faith in all of them, and they all have to do their job.
So it's a question of educating the public in part, you're saying. And you said that earlier, I think, also, Mr. Soren, is that right?
I think so. I think there has been a sense of, you know, people aren't concerned about that. They think everything is safe. And the fact is that as much as we can talk about adherence to codes and good practice, there will be people who will avoid that. And that's where the government sectors, I guess, come in to enforce those codes, do the annual inspections. And I think that might be a concern going forward with this, all of the state budget woes we're hearing in local government financial crisis, where those inspections and code enforcement issues fall in that discussion might be of concern to us.
Mr. Soren, in a high-rise building, if there is any kind of disaster, whether it's a terrorist attack or a terrible fire, in terms of public safety, what is it the public, what's the number one, or the top things that the people who live in that building or anybody visiting that building should know and should do?
Well, they should know what the building safety plan is. They should participate in the drills. If the building's having any, you know, regular fire drills, they need to participate in that. People tend to get complacent about that, and post 9/11 they didn't, but there's been a trend now for people to sort of get a little too comfortable maybe. So they need to participate in that. They need to know where their exiting is. They need to know to listen for any communications that come over a PA system, for example. And just be a part of the system. Jake talked about systems before, and that is part of the system, I think.
All right. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You bet.
Larry Soren is the president of the Building Owners and Managers Association. He joined us from member station KPBX in Spokane, Washington. And with us now on the phone from his office in Arlington, Virginia, is Randy Larson. He's the director of the Institute for Homeland Security, which is part of the Answer Corporation, a not-for-profit think tank. Thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Tragedies like the one in Chicago and Rhode Island might leave people wondering about safety plans and evacuations in the situation where there is a terrorist attack in public buildings, say a mall or a hotel or a nightclub even. A terrorist attack could occur in a restaurant or a nightclub. Do you think businesses are prepared for that or are preparing for that?
I don't think so specifically for the terrorist threat, and I'm a bit concerned if they were spending a great deal of money on that. Many of the preparations that should be there for a terrorist attack would be sufficient if we were better prepared for fires and earthquakes and things like that. So I think we should focus on those things that are a much higher probability. If you're in Southern California, I think the threat of an earthquake is far higher than a terrorist attack in any one particular building or a tornado in Indiana. I'm very concerned about Homeland Security is that we don't spend ourselves into bankruptcy. There seems to be this immediate rush that we have to prepare at every level for every possibility, and we just can't afford it, frankly.
Yeah. Well, are we correctly prioritizing?
Well, you know, I did notice that the Pentagon is now putting 80,000, that's 80,000 protective masks in the Pentagon now, so that the employees and visitors there could evacuate. Now, that's going to be an interesting standard. Is that going to become a national standard that every large office building? I mean, I'm also a vice president of the Answer Corporation, and we have a group of senior leaders now that are looking, what is it we are responsible to provide our employees? I mean, obviously, we're very concerned about their health. We spend a lot of money providing them health insurance because we care about their health. Now, what responsibilities do corporations have? And I think that's a very good question, and I don't think anyone has the answer as of yet.
Yeah. You talk about something called the three rings of security.
Yeah.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. At the Answer Corporation here, we look at three things, and we're involved in all three. And there's the national security ring, and that's everything from, you know, military to arms control treaties to economic policies and trade policies. And then there's homeland security, which I think we all understand is this terrorism threat we have now. And then there's public safety. And that's everything from, you know, having keep you from speeding down the highways or having drunk drivers and fire departments and EMS and all of those sorts of things. Now, when you lay those three things down on a table, those three circles, there is some overlap. And that's what makes it so difficult when people say, well, how much are we spending this year in Homeland Security? Well, if your community buys a new fire truck and some new equipment that would help firefighters respond to a chemical spill, is that public safety money or is that Homeland Security money?
We're talking about public safety and private spaces. The number here is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Steve in San Francisco. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment on a couple of things. One is the buildings that are being designed according to the UBC now are extremely safe buildings for their intent. When you have a wood construction building and you have some kind of fireworks going on the inside, all I can say is that's pretty dumb. The building codes themselves would not prevent that. And something like this, where you've got a conduct going on in a building that was not meant for a building's design, you've got to expect some kind of a disaster. Can we have a code that actually prohibits stupidity on an owner? Pretty tough to do.
Uh-huh.
And I think when you look at buildings across the nation and their history, they are fundamentally very safe structures these days. And all safety codes are ratcheting in only one direction, and it's costing everybody a ton of money. Even though the buildings may be safe, the owners and the greed of the owners is definitely not safe. And I'm not sure it's a code issue. I'm wondering if it's not a law enforcement issue on owners of the building.
Jake Pauls, would you like to respond to that? Thanks so much for your call, Steve.
Yeah.
Yes, the caller was referring to the UBC, which is the Uniform Building Code, which is one of codes used across the country. It is important to deal with things beyond the building construction, and there are standards requiring, for example, some 16 items within a plan when you want to use pyrotechnics, and that's part of the national standard, which references another national standard. So you have to go to that kind of document to deal with the problems he described.
Randy Larson, what's your response to that caller's point?
Well, no, I agree with the economic issues and the cost. And look, I mean, this was an absolute tragedy that happened in both of these nightclubs. There's just no way about it. Our hearts all go out to the families and friends. But, you know, when you have a building like that, and then you use pyrotechnics, and then let's face it, a lot of people in there were drinking. And so maybe when we think about having safety codes for buildings where they are nightclubs, where a lot of people are intoxicated or close to intoxicated, maybe the safety standards, maybe there needs to be more exits easier to get to or whatever when we're designing those, because that is a place where you have a crowded place, it's really noisy, and a lot of people are drunk. And I'm not saying that as a teetotaler. I'm the guy that said make sure you put your scotch in your survival kit for Homeland Security. But we have to understand that these are kind of unique situations, these nightclubs, and that seems to be where so many tragedies occur.
We're talking about public safety and private spaces. Our guests are Randy Larson and Jake Pauls, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to another caller now, George in Hollywood, Florida. Hello, George.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm a professional firefighter. I work as a firefighter for one of the largest fire departments in the country, so I'm going to give you a firefighter standpoint to all this.
Okay.
I've never been to a major fire where the building, whether it be an apartment building, a nightclub, whatever it is, that was sprinklered, where there's actually been a death. You know, each sprinkler head puts out approximately 16 gallons of water a minute. That's a tremendous volume of water. But building owners and building contractors are not going to put sprinklers in unless they need to. It costs money to do so. And I'll give you a quick analogy on a different level, is, you know, just apartment buildings. Our building code here will say that you need a standpipe, which is a built-in water source in an apartment building, where we're able to connect hoses on each floor if you're above 49 feet. So what building owners and contractors do is they built it to 48.5. Now, obviously, they're not meeting the building code, or they're actually meeting the building code. They don't have to put a standpipe in, but that makes it, for me, extremely difficult because now I've got to bring in an outside water source. You know, it's a potential fire trap for all those people. I go on building surveys and inspections all the time where we know the owner is complying with the building code, but when we look at each other, we realize this is a death trap. If something happens in here, we're going to be pulling out bodies right and left. Compliance, is it a law enforcement issue? I tell you, from my standpoint, my job is getting more and more difficult every day.
Let's see if our guests can respond to the points that you're making. And one question I have about this whole law enforcement aspect of it, either Jake Pauls or Randy Larson, is, can you literally have a police force that goes around and checks buildings to make sure that they're in compliance before a tragedy occurs?
I think it is important. I wouldn't call it a police force, but the fire prevention bureaus are the ones that do that now. I would simply add that the fire prevention people have fire safety as their uppermost concern. And when we're dealing with places of public assembly, we should keep in mind that crowd crush can occur just as often as fire deaths can occur. So sprinklers, while they're extremely valuable and necessary, are not the whole story. They perhaps provide half of the protection we need.
Is it at all possible, I don't know, that people would be panicked less if the sprinklers were on and there was some possibility the fire was going out? I mean, is there any way of knowing that?
Well, sprinklers will prevent, you use the word panic. Panic is actually fairly rare. Usually people are confused in the fire and we interpret that as panic and so forth. But certainly the sprinkler will stop the fire from getting to the life-threatening stage where people will get very, very concerned. So they do help.
Randy Larson, do you have any thoughts on...
My concern is that we don't respond to a tragedy by passing some laws that will have a long-term crippling effect on the economy, and the building industry is very important in this country. I mean, even when you look at terrorism, in 2001, 3,000 people died of terrorism in this country. It's a terrible tragedy, but 5,000 people died of food poisoning. Mm-hmm. 35,000 died on public highways in crashes. 98,000 people died of medical mistakes, as we saw this recent tragedy incident down at Duke. So I think we have to keep it in perspective before we start asking for all sorts of new regulations.
And a quick question, Jake Pauls, before you leave. Who do you call if you see violations?
I would call the Fire Prevention Bureau. They're the ones that can move most quickly.
Okay. Thanks so much for being with us today, Mr. Pauls.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jake Pauls is an independent consultant on building use and safety. He joined us here in Studio 3A. And when we come back from a short break, we'll talk about concerns about how terrorism is affecting public art. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Still with us today is Randy Larson, the director of the Center for Homeland Security. One of the groups that's being affected by fears of terrorism is museums, especially those in large cities like New York, Los Angeles, Boston. Joining us now from her office in New York is Lisa Dennison, deputy director and chief curator of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum in New York. Thanks so much for being with us, Ms. Dennison.
Thank you.
Give us an idea of what's happening in museums. What kind of problems are you experiencing because of fears about terrorism?
You're still here?
Yes. I think the problem that we're experiencing is one that has to do with our insurance policies. Traditionally, acts of terrorism were always included as part of your fine arts insurance coverage for a museum. And after 9/11, as policies have been renewed, terrorism is now excluded from standard coverage. It's similar to an act of war. The repercussions of that are quite serious because if a lender insists on that kind of coverage, one has to seek it outside the traditional policy, and it is prohibitively expensive, even if at all available.
And the result of this is, for lenders, they're just refusing to reluctant to lend their pieces for major exhibits. Is that already happening?
I think we're not seeing a tremendous amount of reluctance. There is some, certainly, more among private individuals than institutions. But I think what everyone wants to be assured of is that museums have proper security precautions in place, increased security from previous levels, and that their work is insured for any kind of incident that might happen to it while it's in transit to the museum, the hosting museum, or while it's on the museum's walls.
The concerns about these works of art are really legitimate because a number of works of art were lost on September 11th, were they not?
Well, yes, a number of works of art were definitely lost that were on view at the World Trade Center in various places throughout the buildings. So in any kind of catastrophic accident, even at one's home in an act that's not of terrorism, a fire or anything like that, you can lose works of art. I mean, you know, the world is a fairly dangerous place, but I think that museums are taking every possible precaution to ensure that we are safeguarding our heritage and the works that are entrusted to us.
Specifically, what kind of safety measures have you had to take since 9/11?
Well, I think like most institutions, there's increased security at points of entry, checking bags, checking loading docks, being wary of packages, just a heightened awareness all around.
Randy Larson, you're still with us.
Yes.
I'm wondering if we could talk about the what we've been hearing from Lisa Dennison about the situation museums are in is, of course, the high cost of insurance. First of all, can you give us a sort of big picture cost of insurance since September 11th?
Well, there were enormous losses on 9/11. Warren Buffett, one of the richest people in this country, lost enormous amounts of money, and he said in the future the insurance policies he wrote in the center of buildings in the center parts of major cities, he would not provide coverage for weapons of mass destruction. So that canceled $15 billion worth of construction projects were either canceled or delayed last year because of the inability to get this insurance. And this is a serious problem with the museums, I understand they're having, but I guess what I don't understand is why would a picture or a piece of art be at greater risk from being in a museum in New York City than in Paris? I mean, or London, because I think all these major cities are potential terrorist targets. It's surprising that it's causing it in the art world, I guess. I understand the construction business, but the art world is a bit surprising to hear this.
I think that, first of all, one thing that European governments have, and I think that you're right, the risks are the same in all urban centers, are that their government indemnities or policies which provide the kind of insurance in case of catastrophic loss, which is much harder to get in the United States.
Now, that's a good point, because the secondary insurers in this country have fled the market, particularly immediately after 9/11. And I know specifically in Spain, Italy, and I believe in France, the government is the secondary insurer for many of these cases. So that is a difference now. I understand that a little bit better.
The U.S. government indemnity also does cover terrorist insurance on site. The problem is that there's increased demand for that insurance now because of its terrorist coverage, and they simply can't keep up with the demand, so that even though there are many worthwhile projects out there that the State Department would like to fund through the indemnity program, given that there are more requests, less is being fulfilled just in an effort to spread out the coverage so that certain museums or certain exhibitions aren't penalized.
We're discussing the effects of the concerns about terrorism on museums and other businesses as well. Has your business been affected in any way by such fears and such concerns? Give us a call. The number here is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And you can also reach us at TOTN@NPR.org. Lisa Dennison, have you received any help from the city or from the federal government? Are museums getting any money at all to help them with these additional insurance costs that they're incurring as a result of the fear of terrorism or concerns about terrorism?
Well, the federal government is doing its part through the indemnity program, which is very, very fair and reasonable. The American museums have banded together and have agreed not to charge each other terrorist insurance, so one doesn't have to buy additional premiums if the loan is within the United States. And what we're trying to do is urge our colleagues abroad to have the same sort of understanding so that this does not become a problem of just American museums or just countries that don't have a state indemnification program. But in terms of additional funds to pay for escalating insurance premiums, I don't think you'd find any precedent for that.
Okay. And let me ask you, Randy Larson, I just have one other question. This is the subject we were talking about earlier, but another kind of, this is not a business, it's not a museum, but we got an email from a listener who said, in today's Seattle Times, our most prominent high school was reported to have the highest number of fire code violations for any building in the city this past year. How common is this, and what as parents are we able to do? So here we have yet another kind of institution, schools. Randy Larson.
That's an awfully frightening story to hear. I mean, you know, we send our children to schools, and we certainly expect them to be protected. I'm not the fire expert here. I think he got off the line a little bit earlier. I think the proper response to that would be to go to the fire department and the fire inspectors to get those codes enforced. And we do have, you know, standards, and I think particularly in our public school system here, that's a rather frightening report to me as a parent and a grandparent to hear that the school would have the most violations of any. And back to my line, though, is the best way to be prepared for terrorism with this subject is being prepared to meet these standard codes that we have. So I don't think we need to invent any new ones. Sounds like to me we need to enforce the ones that are already on the books.
And Lisa Dennison, are you finding that concerns about terrorism, is it affecting attendance at all at museums?
I think certainly in New York City we've seen a downturn in attendance, which is trackable to other cultural institutions in the city like Broadway theaters. And while we've recovered somewhat, I think that we are not at the levels that we were prior to September 11th. I don't see any immediate effect of a fear of terrorism keeping people out of museums as a place where they might be at increased risk. But it's been an incredibly healthy season for New York City museums. We have some of the best shows on that we've had in years, and I'm hoping that this will bring a lot of people to New York to see really what the museums have to offer.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Lisa Dennison is the Deputy Director and Chief Curator of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum in New York. She joined us from her office in Manhattan. And thanks also, Randy Larson, for joining us.
Thank you. I took my family to New York for Christmas, and I highly recommend it for a vacation.
Okay. Randy Larson is the director of the Institute for Homeland Security, which is part of the Answer Corporation.